Welcome to the Vermont Conversation. I'm David Goodman. Today we spend the hour with Stuart Stevens. He's been a senior strategist for the political campaigns of Mitt Romney and George W. Bush, and he's also advised Phil Scott when he was a candidate for governor. He's the author of 7 books, a part-time resident of Stowe, but now he says he finds himself homeless in the Republican Party. Stuart Stevens, welcome to the Vermont Conversation.
Great to be here, David. Thank you.
So, a couple of headlines. 2015, The Washington Post. Mitt Romney's top strategist thinks Donald Trump won't win a thing. 2015, New York Magazine. Quote from Stuart Stevens, "For Donald Trump to win, everything we know about politics has to be wrong, and I don't think it is." Close quote. Stuart, what'd you get wrong about Donald Trump?
Well, pretty much everything. I mean, there are a lot of people who are wrong about Trump, but I think it's hard to argue that anyone was more wrong than I was. I don't know how much of that was me not understanding what was going on and how much of it was wishful thinking. The way I looked at Donald Trump was sort of straight on a demographic curve. I always go back to 1980, Ronald Reagan won the sweeping landslide and had 57% of the white vote. Mitt Romney lost with 63% of the white vote. It's really hard to get north of that. Now, Trump was able to because he slightly increased white turnout and non-white turnout was decreased just enough to, well, he lost by 3 million votes, which is in itself, as a veteran of a campaign that lost by 500,000 votes and still won the Electoral College, it's incredibly difficult mathematically to lose by 3 million and still win. We'll probably never see anything like it in our lifetime. I felt the Republican Party should have turned on Donald Trump when he came out for a Muslim ban. I was disappointed that they didn't. And I was disappointed in the way much of the establishment accepted Donald Trump.
Where did that shift happen? You must have felt the tipping point.
You know, in the primary, there were, 16 candidates? And the theory I know of the other 15 who were non-Trump candidates, because I know all these people, was pretty much, it's absurd to think Donald Trump will be the Republican nominee. I mean, we have a guy who's been married 3 times. He was in the casino business. Culturally, he's out of shift with the party. So therefore, if I just get one-on-one with Donald Trump, I will win. So they therefore spent a lot of their time trying to eliminate the other person so they could be one-on-one. So in that sense, it was sort of a murder-suicide pack. It was based on false logic because Donald Trump, the Republican Party, would nominate Donald Trump. I thought that Reince Priebus should have stepped forward and said that Donald Trump can run, can't stop anybody from running, but once he came out for a Muslim ban, say, look, we're not going to support this, and the party won't support him if he wins. I think a lot of it was based upon the assumption that Donald Trump would not win. I think Trump benefited from that both in the primary and the general election. I think he got a number of votes that were protest votes. They weren't really, I want Donald Trump to be president votes. And we were wrong.
Perhaps the most spectacular of the crashes was Jeb Bush, the heir apparent, the next Bush v. Clinton campaign. He was the first one out. What happened to Bush?
And Jeb had a lot of money, too, and particularly in that super PAC. You know, first let me preface this by saying I'm an admirer of Jeb Bush, particularly his tone in politics. He's a smart, interesting person. I think there's a lot of Bush fatigue. And I think the idea of a Bush versus Clinton race kind of made people's head explode. And I think that Jeb was out of touch with where the party is now. You know, Jeb ran in 1994 and lost, and then he ran 4 years later and won. So it had been a very long time since he had been in a competitive race. And I really think, as a consultant, to sit out a cycle even is very dangerous. It's like an NFL coach that goes into the booth and then you go back. It's like, oh, like everything's changed. You have to go out there and try to win the biggest races and win or lose. So I think Jeb was just out of touch with where the party was, and that was a big factor.
When did you begin speaking out publicly against Trump?
As soon as anybody asked me. You know, I sort of knew Trump a little bit. I dealt with him some in 2012, and I lived in New York for a million years and watched him. And I didn't think he would win, but I always thought that he was sort of a negative force. As not really a Trump hater, in the sense, I think as it just depends on the role that he's playing. I think as a New York businessman, actually, Donald Trump did a lot of good things. I mean, I was around in New York in the Battle days, and he pitched in and rebuilt the rink and Central Park, and when a lot of people were abandoning New York, he stayed in New York. So I just thought, though, that as a president, where sort of the soul of the country is so invested in the tone and feel of the presidency, that he would be a disastrous choice.
Well, we've talked about you on Trump. Let's talk about Trump on you. You have played I won't say a starring role, but a minor supporting actor role in his Twitter feed. 2015, the real Donald Trump writes about you. Political strategist Stuart Stevens, who led Romney down the tubes in what should have been an easy victory, has terrible political instincts, exclamation point. 2016, just watch the very incompetent Mitt Romney campaign strategist Stuart Stevens. Now I know why Mitt lost so badly. Stevens is a clown, exclamation point. And later in 2016, you reappear again in the fevered imagination of our president, and he writes, Stuart Stevens is a dumb guy who fails at virtually everything he touches. Romney campaign, his book, etc. Why does Anderson Cooper put him on?
I have these framed as a badge of honor. Why is Trump singling me out?
Yeah, why does he care about you?
Well, no one can really answer that question except Donald Trump and perhaps his psychiatrist. But in a practical sense, you know, in 2011, people have forgotten this because they have lives. You know, he was going to host, moderate a debate, a Republican primary presidential debate that was going to be over the Christmas holidays, sponsored by Newsmax. So, you know, Mitt was like the Mitt version of you crazy. You know, we're not going to do this. We were debating every few minutes. He had 19 primary debates, I think. And it was 3 days after Christmas, and it was Donald Trump. It was like, we're not going to do this. So it fell to me to kill it. And it was very interesting because he was very gentlemanly about it. A very good salesman. His point was just this debate is going to get great numbers, which it might have. I don't know. My point was, like, we don't have a name ID problem. We're not in the high numbers business. It doesn't matter. And then he said, well, eventually when he realized we weren't going to do it, he said, well, this will mean Newsmax will endorse Newt Gingrich and beat up Romney. I was like, you know, Mr. Trump, everybody's going to do what they're going to do. And Newsmax did. It wasn't really a threatening thing. He said it just more matter of fact. Then when he endorsed Romney before the primary in Nevada, which we probably naively saw as not a particularly big deal. As a local businessman in Nevada, he actually does well in these sort of 7 days like surveys of where you'd like to work. They do fine. And we did a couple of three of these a day, like most campaigns. You know, you go to a local business person, they endorse you, you go on. I mean, we spent 15 minutes with it. But then he started calling about how he'd freed his schedule and was ready to go on the plane with us when we left Nevada. It was like, well, no, this isn't going to happen.
This is Trump.
To go on the plane with yes. Trump. And it was interesting because it really was as if he thought that we were saying no because we didn't want to inconvenience him. And it was difficult for him to sort of grasp, like, you know, this wasn't good for him, it wasn't good for us, it wasn't good for anybody. But we said no. And then when Romney won the nomination and started talking about the convention, you know, there were calls about what night he would speak at the convention. I was like, well, You're not going to speak at the convention. Thanks, but no. But it's interesting, you know, he never lost it. I mean, publicly he was quiet about it. But I, as we see now, he doesn't like anyone who opposes him and says no to him. And I said no to him a lot. And I think he watches a lot of television. You know, I found you can write stuff about Donald Trump and no one seems to care. If you go on television for 5 minutes, it has a lot of impact.
You're listening to the Vermont Conversation. We're talking with Stuart Stevens. He's been a senior strategist for the campaigns of Mitt Romney and George W. Bush. And if you want to join the conversation, you can call us at 244-1777, toll-free 877-291-8255. Stuart, we are speaking on the day and perhaps the hour that President Trump signs the biggest tax overhaul since, Reagan,
right,
into law. So let me read a little bit of what's being written about this. Paul Krugman in the New York Times writes, quote, "Unless something drastic happens, this will be the week Republicans ran through a tax cut that adds more than $1 trillion to federal debt while undermining health care for millions. They'll do so by violating all previous norms for major legislation, having held not a single hearing, and rushed to a vote before the new senator from Alabama could be seated. The question is, why are they doing this? For this bill isn't just a policy crime. It also seems to be a political mistake. It will, however, be good one way or another for the bank accounts of quite a few Republican members of Congress. Is that why it will pass?" What's your take on this tax bill?
I find the politics of the tax bill perplexing. I experienced in 2004 re-election campaign for George Bush, where he did cut taxes primarily by making dropping the minimum. So if you know, the goal was if you're a family of four, you wouldn't pay federal income tax. And largely that was accomplished. But when we moved into a campaign mode, no one believed their taxes had been cut. I mean, you would sit in focus groups with people and you go, but like, you don't pay federal tax now. That's a cut. You used to. They go, yeah, but I pay more taxes because everybody's taxes had gone up. And we really found that it did not move people. And if you go back and look in 2004, I'm not sure that we even made an ad about it. We might have, but not many. I think in governor's races, tax cuts can be a very relevant issue. But I find it difficult to see how right now it is a 24% favorable, or 24% of the people are for it. And I think it's going to be interesting to see politically if it's going to have much impact. I mean, the way it's being sold is it's going to have a big impact on people's paychecks, which it won't.
Well, probably one of the ways they're going to feel it is that health insurance is supposed to go up at least 10% in the next year.
Yeah.
That will be a very noticeable 10% of your health insurance is a noticeable change.
I don't see the politics of combining a president with favorables under 40 with a tax bill of favorables of 24, how that's a win. I think it's really perplexing.
So you have aimed your fire at Trump, who, but Trump is not able to do anything without the entire establishment of the Republican Party. And in a piece that I'm sure you read and has been read to you, David Brooks of the New York Times, with a column, and he is the sort of moderate Republican columnist of the Times, in a column titled, I think it was, "The GOP is Rotten." And I just want to read this passage to you and get your take on it. David Brooks writes, quote, "There is no end to what Trump will ask of his party. He is defined by shamelessness, and so there is no bottom. And apparently there's no end to what regular Republicans are willing to give him. Trump may soon ask them to accept his firing of Robert Mueller, and yes, after some sighing, they'll accept that too. That's the way these corrupt bargains always work. You think you're only giving your tormentor a little piece of yourself, but he keeps asking and asking, and before long, he owns your entire soul. The Republican Party is doing harm to every cause it purports to serve. If Republicans accept Roy Moore as a U.S. senator, they may for a couple years have one more vote for a justice or a tax cut, but they will have made their party loathsome for an entire generation. The word evangelical is already being discredited for an entire generation. Today's tax cuts, writes David Brooks, today's tax cuts have no bipartisan support. They have no intellectual grounding, no body of supporting evidence. They do not respond to the central crisis of our time. They have no vision of the common good, except that Republican donors should get more money and Democratic donors should have less. The rot afflicting the GOP is comprehensive, moral, intellectual, political, and reputational. More and more former Republicans wake up every day and realize, I'm homeless. I'm politically homeless. Stuart, why are you a Republican?
Well, it's funny, in professionally in politics, when you start out working for one side, it's very difficult to work for two sides. Very few consultants have been able to do this. You end up not being trusted by either one. David Garth, the famous New York political consultant, used to say he would handle Republicans if he could get to them by subway. And he, like, would, that extended to trains because he also worked for Arlen Specter. So, when I grew up in Mississippi, the Democrats were, old line segregationist. And
George Wallace
was a Democrat, but James Eastland in Mississippi, Stennis, who was a little better, they all were. And it was sort of like, well, why do you want to be for them unless you want to get like a judgeship in Itawamba County? And you just start out working on one side and you continue working on that side. And I think there's a group of us who worked for George Bush in 2000 and 2004, me, Nicole Wallace, who's now on MSNBC, Steve Schmidt, Michael Gerson, who's a columnist for the Washington Post, and we're appalled by Trump because he is against everything that we aspired to be with Bush. Now, I'm not saying we were perfect. I'm not saying we didn't have dark days. I'm not saying that we didn't play to the dark side more than we should have. I think we certainly did. But Bush was someone who really did believe in the uniter, not a divider stuff. The first thing I ever filmed for George Bush was opening a bridge between Mexico and Texas, and now we're going to build a wall. You know, there's a reason Bush in 2004 was able to get 43% of the Hispanic vote. It's just a very, very different concept of what a party should be.
But again, it's not just about Trump.
I think parties, I think, are like people. They have good sides and they have dark sides. And I think the darker side of the Republican Party has been brought into prominence with Trump. Clearly, the failures of the Republican Party have been to appeal to non-white voters. It used to be just African Americans. I mean, before 64, Republican presidential candidates could get around 35% of the African American vote. After 64, it fell off a cliff. Now it's more under 10%. And I think that the party, after the loss in 2012, went through this so-called autopsy where they analyzed everything the party needed to do, a lot of which was appealing to more non-white voters. And then we went and did the exact opposite. And the fact that Trump won, I think, has had the one of the unfortunate things is that it sort of made all the wrong people right for a short period of time. I liken it to, you know, going to a party and having a few drinks and driving home and getting home safely and concluding that alcohol helps you drive better. It's probably the wrong conclusion. And I think what's happened politically with Trump is the wrong conclusion, both in the long term for the Republican Party, but also, I think, in a moral sense. So I think it's a failure that represents internal flaws and failures of the Republican Party. Now, look, there's Charlie Baker in Massachusetts, you know, I work for, Hogan in Maryland. These are people, and there's I could go through the congressmen and senators and see those that I really greatly admire. But I think that Trump compromises everyone in the system who tries to work with him. I mean, it's a Faustian bargain, and the great lesson of Faust is not just that the devil takes your soul, but he never delivers on his end.
I think the part that I find confounding, so he needed 51 votes. We all know how close this Senate is. Susan Collins of Maine objected to people getting tossed off health care. And we find out, okay, instead of 20 million people getting kicked off health care, it'll only be 13 million. She signs on. Corker of Tennessee objects to the deficit. And they've managed to surgically keep the deficit to $1.4 trillion that it will rise. He objects a month ago. Now he signs on, and now it's being called the Corker kickback, the sweetheart deal cut for real estate developers, of which he is one. And Jeff Flake, who had taken a moral stand opposing Trump, has been withering in his criticism, is not up for re-election, and he bails and signs on to a tax cut that is, for lack of a prettier way to put it, going to screw middle and working class people.
I think, you know, and I felt this way about Obamacare. I think that any large legislation that passes that is by party vote is probably a mistake. I think that it just has to have more united support. I feel that way if we had a vote about going to war, that it needs to be of a larger number. One of the reasons we don't have votes about going to war and we just go to war is because people don't want to go on the record anymore. So I think just given the need to try to bring people together more, if you just wake up in the morning, you see something passes on a party vote, it's probably a bad idea, particularly if it's a big thing. Republicans, I think, supported this tax cut largely because there was a sense of what does the party stand for? There's a lot of questioning. And if the party doesn't stand for reducing taxes and shrinking government, it doesn't stand for really anything left of its more historical roots of modern politics. I can't speak to the process that they've gone through of what they tried to get and what they didn't get and what they did. But I think it's bad. I think that Obamacare passed on party line votes was bad, as opposed to the way Mitt Romney got mass health care passed, where he got almost universal support. Only a couple of Republicans voted against that. And it was more popular because of that having to go through that process. We'll see. I mean, I do think that economic growth is a huge thing. I mean, if we could have 3% GDP growth consistently, it would make a very positive difference in a lot of people's lives. The question is the cause and effect.
There's no economist who has said that works. A chicken in every pot.
Can be how people end up worshiping volcanoes, because volcano belches and it rains and you think there's a connection. We'll see what happens. My fondest hope is that it does work and that that we have 3% plus growth. That would help everybody.
Okay, well, we're going to take a break. We're talking with Stuart Stevens. He's been a strategist for Mitt Romney, George W. Bush, and others. You're listening to Vermont Conversation. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Vermont Conversation. I'm David Goodman. We're spending the hour this week with Stuart Stevens. He has been a top Republican campaign strategist for Mitt Romney, George W. Bush, and others. And Stuart, talk about what led you to Vermont. It was not politics.
Right. I came to Vermont because I spent 4 summers at the Breadloaf School of English at Middlebury College to get a master's, which was a fantastic best educational experience I ever had. And I really fell in love with Vermont. A million years ago, I was able to get a place in Stowe, and I've tried to spend more time here. And I love it. I have this passion for cross-country ski racing, which was one of the reasons it brought me here. I do it badly, but I do it fervently. It's really a place that I feel very, very comfortable in, though it's difficult to find a place more different than my native Mississippi.
So talk a little bit about Mississippi. You have written a number of books. Race has been a big part of Mississippi's stories and your stories. You've described how your high school classmates applauded upon learning of Martin Luther King's assassination. And now we have the spectacle of the race we just had in Alabama for Senate, where 96% of all black voters voted for Doug Jones, while 3/4 of white men voted for Roy Moore. Are we fighting the Civil War all over again?
Well, you know, I think race is the key in which all life is lived, certainly as a Southerner, probably as an American, and maybe everywhere in the world. The greatest determinant factor in your life, certainly in the South, will be, has been race. You know, I wrote this book about growing up in Mississippi called The Last Season that was focused on the bond that my father and I had when I was growing up by going to college football games, particularly Ole Miss football games. And arguably 1962, when there was a riot over the integration of University of Mississippi, was the last pitched battle of the Civil War. There were 30,000 troops in Oxford, Mississippi. And it's interesting because I think Ole Miss is probably the most southern university in the most southern state. And you go there now, and there has been a lot of progress. I mean, today, the only reason there would be a riot over a black entering Ole Miss would be if a black athlete like committed to Ole Miss and like decommitted. And it is a fascinating look at the cultural changes. I think college football has played a role, much like rugby in South Africa, that it's the first time blacks and whites actually cheered for each other. So I think in the South, things are a lot better. There's been a lot of efforts in the South, I think, to address the past. Certainly you've seen this reflected through all aspects of the South. You know, my father started a law firm, which I'm in Jackson, Mississippi, and I'm glad to say they were a initial and very large contributor to the Civil Rights Museum, which just opened in Jackson. We never had a Civil Rights Museum. And it's an extraordinary, successful museum that they have created now. So I think things are better. But you look at what happened in Alabama, and it's both encouraging and dispiriting. I find it very moving, because I think it really was an extension of the civil rights movement. The fact that this guy, this accused pedophile and lunatic, Roy Moore, would have been in the Senate if it weren't for African-American voters, particularly African-American women, which, not just the numbers that he got, like 99% of African-American women, but 97% of all African-Americans, but the numbers in which they turned out, I think is very powerful. Now, I did a race against Roy Moore. I was working for the governor of Alabama, and Roy Moore primaried. I mean, we beat the guy 2-1. I mean, it was easy to point out he was a nut. And we didn't get into any of the opposition research about his sleazy past, because every day he says something crazy. So he could just put out his own press releases. So I think it's sort of the best of times and worst of times.
What do you feel, as somebody who grew up in the South, Charlottesville, you know, these dark forces, the Klan, the white supremacists have always been there. But then to have the President of the United States signal his approval of them, saying there's good people on that side, you know how incendiary this is. Mm-hmm. But describe for a Northern audience what that signals.
It's disgraceful. It's disgraceful for the President to say that. And it's heartbreaking, the idea that these racist elements would get encouragement. And I think one of the darkest sides of the Trump presidency has been those kind of encouragements to race. I mean, when he went down to campaign for Luther Strange, and attacked protesting black athletes in Alabama and calling them sons of bitches. It's an extraordinarily dark moment. I mean, in a place where not that long ago, protesting blacks were being lynched and where so much blood and tears have been spent just for the right to vote. It sort of lacks any sort of context unless you're doing it on purpose. And I think what words matter, and I think when the president gives encouragement to those sides, it's extraordinarily dangerous.
Now, one of the paths to power for the Republican Party over the last 40 years has been the Southern strategy, this skating right on the edge and sometimes falling over it. You know, famously in the race against Michael Dukakis, the Willie Horton ads that were used. As a Republican advisor, why is it that Republicans keep going to this well, cannot resist this kind of appeal to Southern racists?
Well, look, I think the greatest failure of the Republican Party before 2016 was the failure of the modern Republican Party to appeal to African Americans. And I think you have to ask very tough and serious questions as to why that is. And I think you have to start with this is a tremendous failure. It was at one time mostly limited to African Americans. Republicans could do well with Asians. Republicans could do well with Hispanic voters. But now that's extending where we're doing worse. I think it is a huge failure. And I think it's incredibly ominous for the Republican Party going ahead, just for the changing demographics of the country. But I think it also goes to a sort of a moral leadership. And I think that if you're not more responsible in being able to attract more of a segment of voters that look like America, it's difficult to have a moral imperative to govern.
How do you put that genie back in the bottle?
I mean, it's
for
very hard.
Candidates in the South to see Trump fan these flames and get results. And for all we can crow about Roy Moore losing, he barely lost.
I did a race in Mississippi a couple of years ago when Dad Cochran was primary by a guy named Chris McDaniel, who got a lot of, this got a lot of attention because it was seen as sort of a harbinger of these dark forces. And we were able to beat him. In part because of African-American support for Thad Cochran.
Which was a bit ironic, because Cochran has his own policies on race.
Well, Cochran, you know, goes to the history of Mississippi. When Cochran came up, he very much was... There used to be a moderate on race. There was an expression in Mississippi in those days in the South, are you good on race? And Cochran was always good on race. He was supported by Charles Evers. He never played to the dark side. In any of his tones, and really stood up for it when, at a time, it was very difficult to stand up for it. But I think that this is a question the Republican Party has to ask itself and has to try to do better. And it's not just about winning an election. It's about proving that you are a moral force to govern the country.
As an advisor to candidates, sometimes in the South, would you go there if polls told you that, you know, if you can make the case to white voters that this candidate has white interests at heart, how do you tell that candidate, don't go there?
Well, you know, my experience has been you don't want to work for people that want to go there. And I worked for Haley Barbour in Mississippi. And Haley never went there. He never did the stuff that Roy Moore did or Chris McDaniel did. And I think that these issues, how you say and what you say, really matters. There's no question that this sort of code words and whatnot really works. The people that want to hear it, hear it. But listen, I think it's very troubling when you look at the South. Of, I mean, Roy Moore is an extreme example, but Republicans should do better with African-American voters. I mean, they really need to. I don't know any. There's no one I work for who didn't agree with that statement. I mean, it's almost axiomatic. We're getting 10% of this large group of voters. We need to do better. And some have. I mean, you get some to get up, you know, to getting upwards of 20%+. Senator Scott hopefully will do better. But still, it is a huge and resonating failure. And I don't see that you go to your question about getting the genie back in the bottle. I think that what Donald Trump is saying is going to have lasting impact.
You like to win. You've talked about liking to fight. But you have lost some very big races in a very public way. How do you deal with loss?
I found out very early in politics that losing stays with you a lot longer than winning. The joy of winning is far eclipsed by the pain of losing. The Secret of Success as a Political Consultant is to work for people who are going to win anyway. I mean, just to work for good candidates. I've been really lucky. Certainly in the Romney case, we lost, and I took it very personally, and it really led me into this reflective mood that resulted in this book that I wrote the last season, which is really a reflection on loss. I think that there's dignity in loss. I think that losing is not the worst thing. If you can lose more than an election. As you said earlier, I think you can lose your soul. And if you take someone like Mitt Romney, you know, Mitt is sort of constitutionally one of the most well-balanced, fundamentally decent and happy persons I've ever encountered. I mean, he realizes he's one of life's lucky people on multiple levels, and he's very grateful for that. And I think you see him speaking out on Trump, and he didn't have any bitterness about the loss. But it's loss is probably the key in which life is lived. I mean, this idea that we're all mortal and we're all going to die is probably true. And I think those who realize that earlier are more fortunate than those who realize it later.
We're talking with Stuart Stevens. He's been a top Republican strategist. If you want to join the conversation, you can call 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. Talk about that book, The Last Season. You wrote it after the Mitt Romney loss. What did you set out to do there, and what is the book about?
Well, you know, I grew up in Mississippi. I'm actually a seventh-generation Mississippian, and one of the ways my father and I really bonded was by going to college football games, particularly Ole Miss football games. And then Ole Miss had a lot of games in Jackson, Mississippi at the time. And I think any parent child who can discover something they like to do where they can talk about nothing but talk about everything is a great experience. My father in 2012 turned 95, and I, in this process of sort of dealing with loss and thinking about loss, I wanted to spend time with him and my mother, who was in her late 80s then. So we, that fall in 2013, we went to all of the Ole Miss football games together with my mother, which kind of gave it a driving Miss Daisy quality. I used that as a framework to write this book that was really sort of a meditation on loss. And growing up in the South, and a lot of the issues that revolve around race, because I really think the college football story in the South is so integral to the racial history of the South. And one has influenced the other, and each has been changed as a result. So law of unintended consequences. I mean, if you look at Alabama, which was one of the first to get African-American players, powerhouse teams, Bear Bryant realized this very early on, in part due to Joe Namath. They realized after they started getting African-American players that, like, they should get some African-American women, or they're going to have African-American players going out with white women. So, you know, you start out wanting to get a fullback, and you end up with a female math major, and that's how social change happens. And it's tremendously positive in that sense. But it the South is consumed just with the reality of, it's, as Faulkner wrote to it, the reality of the past and the reality of the race. And one of the things that's been most troubling to me about the Trump presidency is we're actually having debates about the Civil War, like about slavery. Whether or not the Civil War was about slavery. Of course the Civil War was about slavery. I mean, if you look at the 13 states and read their original secession statements, they all mention slavery. And you take Mississippi. Mississippi went from being the fifth richest country, richest state in the nation, to the poorest after the Civil War, which was about slavery. And it's just so disturbing to have this question relitigated from the White House. I think it's very sobering and depressing.
So after a year of attending Ole Miss football games with your dad, and what you're saying about Ole Miss earlier, I am reminded of a column that was in the New York Times earlier this year, headlined, "My Family Didn't Accept Me, Ole Miss Did," and it was about this opening paragraph is, "It may sound surprising, but many colleges in the Deep South are welcoming environments for gay students. Until my freshman year at the University of Mississippi, I never felt free to be myself." And this young man describes being turned out by his family, but being welcomed at Ole Miss, which was very, for me, born and raised in the North, Ole Miss meant one thing. It was that image of troops defending the last bastion of, white education, back in the 60s. You've described a lot of your work with candidates. Have you ever worked with a woman candidate?
Yeah, I've worked with a number. Some have won, some who have lost. It's interesting, I found that if you sit around in these rooms with female candidates, males working on the campaign tend to spend a lot of time trying to come up with how we should do things differently because she's a woman. And to my knowledge, we've never come up with anything that was really relevant. So we just end up doing what we do with with male candidates for the most part. And I think that's it's tricky to try to do that. There's been a lot of talk about the Hillary Clinton being a terrible candidate and all of this. I'm actually of the opinion she wasn't such a terrible candidate. I mean, she won three debates, which is incredibly difficult to do. As someone who's been involved in a lot of debate preps on presidential level, it's incredibly difficult to win three debates, just law of averages. It's like sweeping the World Series. They had a great convention, which is also very, very difficult to do. I think that she lost a lot of votes, particularly at the end, because she was female. And I think that there was definitely a misogynist element that worked against her. I think one of the great things about the Me Too movement now is a focus on the difficulties of being female in this moment that has existed for some time and highlighting it. And I think it's not insignificant that you rarely see women accused of sexual harassment or assault. I'm in the 28th Amendment should be only women should vote mood. And just take men out of the equation, I think we would be probably a lot better off.
And should only women run?
Should certainly elect a lot more women.
To recap, 20% of the Senate, I think that or a bit lower in the House of Representatives. There are only 6 women governors.
I think you have
terrible.
To peel it back, right? Part of it, I think, it's of a piece, right? So, people who run for office these days tend to be more wealthy than not. And men tend to be more wealthy than women still. And I think if you started with, you had a same proportion of wealthy men as wealthy women in this country, that would be a portal, weirdly, in our system to more women running and more women winning. And I think it's just all of a piece of how women have been disadvantaged in our economic portion. I think that there's traditional aspects where women have been still, because men haven't stepped up to take responsibility, have been more responsible and feeling more of a need to deal with having children and raising children should be equal. It's not. So I think, running for office, as I'm sure you've witnessed, is an incredible sacrifice and an incredible personal pain. And I think a lot of men do it without realizing what it means for the family until they've done it. I've seen this over and over again, particularly in Congress, with the difficulties, you know, now people don't move to Washington as much anymore. So I hope all of that will start to level out. There's no easy answer for it.
You have written and spoken approvingly of Bernie Sanders. What's your take on him and his chances, and how would you advise Bernie when he calls you, Stuart Stevens?
I don't think that's going to happen.
As a campaign advisor.
I have great respect for what Bernie did. I remember when I was riding my bicycle down Church Street, and there's this guy out there yelling about rent control a million years ago, and he was running for mayor. And the idea that a guy that had never gotten more than, 200 and something thousand votes could launch a national campaign / movement, just in a poli-sci sense, whether you're for it or against it, is incredibly impressive, just as a piece of political accomplishment. And their ability to raise money. I mean, this is, you know, they were raising over $1 million a day without fundraisers, which is as close to alchemy in politics as you can imagine. And people used to talk about, well, when Sanders going to get out? And I was like, guys, are you insane? They wake up every day, they get $1 million. They're not going to get out. No, most campaigns end because they run out of money, not because somebody all of a sudden decides, like, well, I don't want to win anymore, or I can't win. Most people who run for office lose overwhelmingly. Many are called, few are chosen. But what drives people out of the races is money, more often than not, unless there's some scandal. And, of course, now we're seeing that people stay in despite scandals. So in that sense, I really had a lot of respect for Bernie. I think Bernie's politics are wrong in a lot of regards, but I think that he has a consistent worldview. And the Bernie Sanders I heard when he was running for mayor is pretty much the same Bernie Sanders I hear now. You know, I think the tragedy of somebody, call it tragedy, I think the problem with Bernie Sanders is, like, he didn't endorse Jones in Alabama. That's dumb. You have somebody running against Roy Moore. You should support him. You know, he may not be perfect in as far as lining up with your politics.
Was Bernie asked? Did anybody
want Yes, and he didn't. He didn't because he thought that he wasn't, you could ask him, but he wasn't sufficiently left. I think that's a real flaw in the system, be it on the right or the left.
We have just a minute or two left here. You are now in your 60s. You probably have a campaign or two left in you. What for you would be the crowning achievement of the work that you do, and also of the tumult that you have experienced of essentially being on the outside of your party looking in?
Well, I would love the Republican Party to fundamentally reject the dark side of Trumpism.
Would you be willing to leave the Republican Party if that continues to be the mainstream?
Well, leaving the party, I think, is sort of a symbolic thing that doesn't really mean anything. I mean, we don't have, in Mississippi, certainly, I'm enculturated with that, because we don't have party registration. We used to always say party is a state of mind. So I never have thought that way. You know, I would hope that someone, if Donald Trump is still president, which he probably will be in 2020, that he's primaried by someone who represents a different vision of the party and wins. And I'd love to work for that person and help them win if I could, because I think that having better choices is better. I wouldn't support him if he runs for re-election. I didn't support him now. A lot of good it did. He still won.
Do you have any regrets?
Oh, I'm consumed with regret. I think, you know, even races I've won, I spend a lot of time regretting things that we did, just everything. That's just how I am. I think it draws to the side of me that writes. But I'm spending, you know, a lot of time working with governors I like and also writing books.
Okay, well, we're going to have to leave it there. Stuart Stevens, a top advisor to Mitt Romney, George W. Bush, and others, and a author of many books. Thanks so much for joining us.
Great to be here, David. Thank you.
That does it for this week's Vermont Conversation. You can hear this and all shows at VermontConversation.com. We'll be back next Wednesday at 1 with another Vermont Conversation. I'm David Goodman. Thanks for listening.
The Vermont Conversation with David Goodman.